Welcome to the weekly sermon podcast of Valley Grove Baptist Church. We are thankful you stopped by to hear from God's Word, to grow closer to Him, and to be inspired to reach your area of influence.
All right, if you've got your Bibles this morning, let's go ahead and find 1 Samuel chapter 8. 1 Samuel chapter 8, as we are continuing to work our way through 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel chapter 8, which presents a very unique and marked change in the book of 1 Samuel. We're moving into a new era, if you will, a new era of Israelite history and a new era of really the Old Testament. And so, because today marks the change from the era of the judges to the era of the kings, as we will see. It's kind of interesting as I was reading this week and preparing. It's interesting because just when you think Israel's doing it right and they're doing good and everything is looking on the up and up, they've just won a great victory with the Lord's help. They've just done the right thing by choosing to serve Him and acknowledging their sin and repenting both privately and corporately through this great event. The Philistines were defeated very badly, such that they didn't make any other incursions. And then we turn the page to chapter 8, and you're like, oh, guys, what are we doing? All right. So this morning, we're going to read a little bit and talk and read a little bit and talk and read a little bit and talk. And then at the end, we'll kind of ask, hey, what is this story telling us? And then we'll try to draw some comparisons through application of what the main point of the story is. Everybody ready? All right. So let's read. 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 1. When Samuel became old, he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn son was Joel, and the name of his second was Abijah, or however you want to pronounce it. Sounds good to me, right? They were judges in Beersheba. Verse 3. Yet his sons did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after gain or money. They took bribes and perverted justice. All right, so this story, to this point, verses 1 through 3, give you the background material you need to understand why what happens in the rest of the chapter. So the rest of the chapter is an outflow of verses 1 through 3. And so what do they tell us? Samuel is old, right? Now, we've read periodically that Samuel has come to power, so to speak, and come to be the guy, the man in which Israel turned to for guidance and wisdom. And he made kind of like he was like a old-timey circuit preacher here in America. He would ride the circuit, and he'd go from the north to the south, and he would judge Israel. Means he would literally be like a judicial actor, a judicial judge. He would also share God's word. They would come to him in great times of crisis and all of that. But Samuel has become aged, and he's probably stopped riding the entire circuit, hence why he makes his sons judges in Beersheba. Now, you say, where is Beersheba? It is in the remote south, right? It is way down there, right? Like below the Dead Sea kind of thing. And so logistically speaking, it's probably that Samuel takes the top half and they take the bottom half, right? Well, since they're all the way down there by themselves out of the watchful eye of their father, what happens? They decide to take bribes. In other words, what that means when it says they go after gain and take bribes, it is when a case is being adjudicated between you and someone else, if you gave them some money, they would rule in your favor whether you were right or wrong. Right? Now that's obviously not a good thing at all. And it obviously is so well known that they take bribes that by it being included in the text here, it is so well known that it is known outside of Beersheba just like it is known inside of Beersheba, which is why in verse number 4, we read these words. All right, what does verse 4 say? It says, "Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah." Verse 5, here's what it says. "And said to him, Behold," I love the candor, "you are old." You're old. "And your sons do not walk in your ways." Now, let's stop right there. Again, how do these people know their son, his sons don't walk in their ways? Because their ability or desire to take a bribe has left the city. It's kind of one of those things like, it's one thing if we know something about Thomaston because we live here, but if it's another thing if it's something really good or really bad and it gets outside and then everybody knows about it, like it becomes this thing. This is exactly what's going on here. It's one thing if the city knows. It's another thing if all the elders, all the religious leaders, all the political leaders in the entire tribal confederation know, hey, this is bad. And so in future times, this would be known as a crisis of succession. And the reason that it is a crisis of succession is, as I was studying this week, I was like, I can hear the conversations of these elders. Hey guys, Samuel's old. He could die at any moment. And word has gotten to us that his sons, they're treacherous. They'll take bribes. They may or may not do the right thing. And then one guy in an excited fit goes, "What are we going to do?" Because there's been all of this positiveness and following God and Samuel being the guy that they're like, "What's going to happen to us now?" And so verse 5 tells us that they come to a conclusion. Let's read the last half of the verse. What do they tell Samuel? "Now, appoint for us a king to judge us like all the nations." So what's their idea? We need a king. That was easy. Problem solved. Now, the rest of the chapter is going to be about this desire to have a king. But if we're honest with ourselves, this really doesn't seem like that big of a deal to us, just on the surface, right? Like, if we didn't know any of the history of the Old Testament, and it's fine if you don't, if we didn't know any of what would happen next, because we've read ahead, and if you haven't, that's fine too. Keep coming. We're going to read it together. We would be like, well, why is it such a big deal that they want a king? Because in our minds, this is like the natural progression of societies, right? If you're any student of history at any depth, you realize that if you get big enough, power, in some sense, naturally has to centralize because it gets too broad, it gets too wide, and it gets hard to work together. Now, we don't want a king, right? You don't want a king. I don't want a king because that's not our jam in America. But Christians all over the world live underneath kings, people in Great Britain and other countries around the world work successfully under a king. So it's like somewhat the natural course of history that power consolidates as it gets way out. It comes back up. And then we've seen it runs, now not always successfully, but it can be run successfully. And so on one hand, it's like, well, this is a big idea. Why are we even talking about this, guys? This kind of makes sense. Because at this time, Israel is this loose confederation of 12 tribes that somewhat like each other sometimes, and at other times don't. And it sometimes work together, and it sometimes don't. And so it just seems like this is the natural progression of the political state. But let's keep going. Verse number 6. Let's see how Samuel responds. "But the thing displeased Samuel." That might be an understatement. "It greatly displeased Samuel." Now, what's interesting, and we don't have time to touch on this, is what does it say he's displeased about? Does it say he's displeased about the actions of his sons? No, which is like, well, that's kind of weird. But the point is not his sons. The point is the question about asking for a king. And so, but the thing displeased Samuel that they said, "Give us a king to judge us." And Samuel prayed to the Lord. Now, why would it displease Samuel? Real quick. Number one, because, and this is the crux of the issue, this is not what God had designed for Israel. That's one reason. We'll talk about that at length. The other reason Samuel is greatly displeased is because, I mean, let's just be real. what they're inevitably saying is, Samuel, thanks, but no thanks. Thanks for all you've done for us, but we're moving off of you. You done good, buddy. Now, we need something else. So how do you think that made Samuel feel? Like a punch to the gut? Like, you sorry jokers, all I've done for you, and this is how you're going to treat me in the twilight of my life. Yeah, this is what they're going to do, right? But more than that, it is about this idea and why there's this idea that the king is bad is because from the inception, from post the crossing of the Red Sea, you know, let my people go, Moses, Pharaoh says no. Then after all these plagues, he finally says yes, and Israel crosses the Red Sea, and they are headed to the Promised Land, and they make this stop at Mount Sinai, and God does a lot of stuff there, Ten Commandments, smoke and fire, and all of this stuff on the mountain. Well, in that section of Exodus, God tells Israel what they're supposed to be. And God tells them they're supposed to be a, listen to the language, a theocracy, not a monarchy. In other words, God is supposed to be their king, and they are supposed to be a holy nation and a kingdom of priests unto the Lord. In other words, everybody in the entire nation should be serving God. And that whole kingdom of priests means that everybody should be like ambassadors or priests to the Lord, sharing the good news of God and what He's done to all the nations around them. That was to be, and God was their king, and they were His servants. There was never this intention that as they moved to the Promised Land, that they should become, key word there, should become a monarchy like all the other nations. So when Samuel hears this, not only is he hurt personally, but he's also very displeased because he knows this is a step away from God's best and God's perfect design for Israel. But in the midst of that hurt and anguish, what does Samuel do? He prays to the Lord. Now, we could camp out here, but I just want to touch. This is not on your outline, but this is free. Samuel does exactly what you and I should do in the moments when we're hurt, displeased, or sorrowful, or things ain't going the way we think they are. When someone tells you, you're old, we don't need you anymore, right? What should you do? Run to Facebook and vent your problems? No. Samuel did not go down to the corner store and tell everybody. What did he do? Prayed, which is exactly what you should do. Now, the response that he gets, I promise you, is not the response he thought he was going to get from the Lord. But let's read it. Here we go. Verse 7. Samuel prayed. And the Lord said to Samuel, shocker, obey the voice of the people and all that they say to you. So what does God say? Give them a king. And then He's going to tell him some encouragement, or well, hopefully a little bit of encouragement. For they have not rejected you, but me. But they have rejected me from being king over them. Verse 8. According to all the deeds they have done. In other words, God's talking about the nation now. According to all the deeds that the nation has done, from the day, listen to this, from the day I brought them out of Egypt to this day, what have they done? Forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are also doing to you. In other words, God says, Samuel, trust me, you're not the problem, they're the problem. And they've been doing this for centuries now. Not decades, centuries at this point. It's not you, buddy. I promise you. They're rejecting me. Kind of reminds you of what Jesus would say 1,000 years later to His disciples. Hey, guys, if you serve me, just like they persecuted me, they're going to persecute you. Hey, if you follow me, you will have trouble in this world, but no fear, I've overcome the world, right? Those kind of things. And so God is encouraging Samuel, saying, hey, listen, it's okay. Give them a king. No, they are not forsaking you. They're forsaking me. And in verse number 9, He tells Samuel exactly what He wants him to do. And here's what He says. Now then, obey their voice. In other words, go make them a king. But only you shall solemnly warn them and show them the ways the king who shall reign over them. In other words, God gives Samuel a commission. He says, hey, it's okay. Give them a king. Make them a king. But before you do, tell everybody exactly what the king is going to do. And in the next 9 verses, Samuel lists all the ways that the king, what he presents is, the best way to say it is this transaction that's going to occur. Now, here's what the people want. The people say, give us a king like all the other nations. So that's one part. Here's what the people want. Give us a king like all the other nations to rule over us. And then later they'll say, we'll read in a minute, they'll say, so that he can go into battle before us. So what the people want is someone to rule and to be at the head of the army to go into battle. And to quote the great American economist, truly great American economist, Thomas Sowell, he says, life is about trade-offs. Here's the trade-off. Okay, if you want a king to rule over you and to go in battle, here's what it's going to cost you. And next 9 verses, verses 10 through 18, Samuel tells all the elders that are at his house that day, here's what it's going to cost you. Now, we're not going to read all of them, but I do have a list for you on your outline if you want to look at it, and I'll briefly go over them. He says, number one, the king will listen to the words, take your sons and make them soldiers, charioteers, horsemen, and runners. He will appoint or make commanders of armies. He will appoint or make farmers and harvesters. He will make people to make equipment makers, fabricators. He will take your sons and daughters, your daughters, and make them domestic household workers for his household. He will take your best fields, vineyards, and flocks, or orchards, fields, vineyards, and orchards. He will take 1/10 of your grain, vineyard produce, and your flocks. He will take your servants, young men, and donkeys. In other words, your workforce. And so Samuel goes through and says, did you hear? It says he's going to take and make, take and make, take and make. What is totally missing in these 9 verses? Here's how the king is going to serve you. That's not in there. You can read it. You can go down and read 10 through 18. There's no mention of, hey guys, here's the good things the king's going to do for you. There's none of that. It is all, okay, this is what you want. He's going to take, 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 take. He's not going to ask your opinion. He's not going to get your input. He's going to take the best fields you got, the best sheep you got, the best goats you got, the best trees you have, the best orchards. He's going to, then not only is he going to take your field, but then on what's left, what is not your best, he's going to say, hey, by the way, now there's this thing called a tax, and you've got to pay 1/10 that you didn't previously have to pay. You've got to pay to me for the upkeep of my household. So not only are you losing your most productive fields, flocks, trees, orchards, and vineyards, but on the other 90% that you have, or you've got to make up, and then off of that, you've got to then pay another 10th. Is the trade-off equal? No. Because here's the deal. What do they want? Someone to rule over us. Okay. And then someone to go into battle for us. Well, I'm just going to just throw this out there. Very few times does the king actually be the one that's at the front of the battle. Right? Because if he's at the front of the battle and dies, what happens? We have no king anymore. Right? And then we're left with, who's going to rule over us now? Right? And so they want all of that, Samuel's like, okay, hey, if you want this, it's trade-offs. If you want this, God says you can have it, but just know it's going to require this right here, year after year after year after year after year after year. And that's just, listen, That's just all of the labor force, army, produce, agricultural, economic stuff. The coup de grace of all of this that you're going to have to give up comes in the last two verses. And listen to what he says. Samuel says to the Israelite leaders, hey, if you want this, listen, you will be his slaves. Ooh. Like above all of this making and taking of people and produce and land and agriculture and economics, that it's going to cost you more than that, you will be indebted to him forever, or to the monarchy forever. You will not get out of it. And then to top it even above that, the last verse Samuel says to these leaders is, hey guys, there's going to come a day when you're going to go, this is a bad idea. That's my paraphrase. That's not exactly what they say. I'm just paraphrasing it. And he said, in that day, you're going to pray to God. And he says, God is not going to hear you. Ooh. It's just going to be a day when you're like, oh man, the king's a bad guy. Wish y'all didn't want this. And Samuel tells them, and you're going to pray, and God's going to go, I gave you exactly what you wanted. Now, let's just camp here just for a second. This is not the main point of the story, but it is worth just for a second. I often wondered in my life how many times I've prayed for stuff and God's been like, okay. And then a few months, a few years later, I was like, hey, I don't want this anymore. And God's like, but you did. And I gave it to you. Here you go. Right? And it's not God's fault. It's my fault. Like, he gave me exactly what I wanted. And then I got it, and I didn't want it. Because I didn't have the wisdom and the knowledge enough to see that thing that I wanted, where it would inevitably end up, and it wouldn't take me exactly where I thought it was going to go. But this is what Samuel is telling Israel. Hey guys, you think you want this now, but there's going to be a day when you don't want this thing. And unfortunately, you're going to be stuck with it. Right? So, on one hand, kind of a little side point is, be careful what we ask for. Because sometimes the Lord gives it to us. And it turns out to be a step away from what would be best for our lives. Right? All right, so, then the chapter ends, verses 19 through 22, with the Israelite leaders saying, hey, but the people refused to obey the voice of the Lord. And they said, hey, no, but there shall be a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us in battles. And when Samuel heard all the words of the people, he repeated them in the ears of the Lord. In other words, he prayed again because he's still upset about this thing. And then the Lord said to Samuel, obey the voice and make them a king. And Samuel said to the people, go every man to a city. In other words, I'm tired of talking to y'all. Right. And so what do we see? If we were to ask this question, what is this story trying to tell us today? Well, on one hand, it is from a very just off the surface, very surface level view. It is simply telling us about how Israel moves, kind of the catalyst for Israel moving from a tribal confederation of 12 loosely defined tribes that sort of work together to a kingdom, to what would become an empire, a small one, but an empire, right? And so in some sense, it is the historical movement from one type of political system to another type of political system. But what this story, that's a surface level view. But when we dig just a little bit deeper, what we see is this story is telling us much more about the spiritual condition of the hearts and lives of the people, mainly the leaders in Israel, more than it is just telling us about political movement from one type of government to another. And what does it tell us about the spiritual condition of the people? Put it to you bluntly. They were willing to give up God's best for something less. Right? What was God's best for Israel? Theocracy. What did they want? Less monarchy. And really, the key phrase in this entire chapter is, like the nations. What did Israel really want to be like? Did they really want to have a dedicated heart only for the Lord? No. What did they really want to be like? The nations. Right? Give us a king, make us a king to rule us like the nations that can rule us and go out in battle before us. It was like they looked around and were like, hey, we're not in the cool kids club. Everybody else has a king but us. We should be like them. When in God's design and God's best, they were never meant to be like the nations, right? What's interesting about this story is that about several hundred years before this, God said this exact thing was going to happen. Like, verbatim in Deuteronomy. You can find it in Deuteronomy chapter 17, verses 14 through 15. This is what God tells the people through Moses. Here's what he said. This is God's. God said, when you come to the land that the Lord your God is giving you, and possess it and dwell in it, and then say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me. I mean, verbatim. You may indeed set a king over you whom the Lord your God will choose. One from among your brothers you shall set as king over you. You may not put a foreigner over you who is not your brother. And then after that, it goes on to list several requirements for what the king must do, right? But before they even got in the land, God said, hey, one day y'all gonna walk away from me, and you're gonna choose to have a king. And I'm gonna give you one. But you're gonna have to give up all of this stuff. And Israel's like, yes, sign me up for that. And so they're willingly walking away from God's best for something less. And that's kind of the point of the story, is whenever we, to put it, maybe to kind of transition into what does that mean for you and me today, whenever God's people, whenever we want to be like the world, we are always moving away from God's best to something that is less. Right? Whenever we want to be like the world, say it again, whenever we want to be like the world, be like the nations, that's what it means. Right? The New Testament terminology would be the world. Right? Whenever we want to be like the nations, whenever we want to be like the world, we are moving away from God's best to something that is less. All right, so now I want to tell you how we're going to do this application point, okay? All right, so I want to make sure you're following with me what we're trying to do. So what I did was, what I tried to do this week, I hope we'll see at the end if it all works out the way I think it is. What I tried to do is ask two questions, or I asked a very simple question. What would it look like if we wanted to be like the nations? All right, because Israel wanted to be like the nations, and God said, okay, but here's the trade-off. What would that be like in our context? If we said, hey, we want to be like the nations, okay, here's the trade-off. Okay, you with me? So I did this in two levels, church and personal. Okay? You with me so far? Very good. All right. So here's what. Whenever the church, what is one way the church, big C or individual, little c, what is one way the church can be like the nations? Okay, well, there's a lot of things we could probably fill in that blank with. We only got time for one. Okay? So, whenever the church, whether big or small, values entertainment as a top priority, it is living like the nations. Okay? Whenever the church values entertainment, that is a step toward living like the nations. Now, let's be real, okay? Let's just be real. Follow with me. there is a minute level of entertaining that goes on everywhere, right? If we came up here and Mr. Ernie sang every song monotonely, and Miss Reba, when she's here, or we found the most god-awful YouTube version of a hymn, and we sang with no passion and with no zeal, and just, Lily of the Valley, bright and morning star. You would go, And if I came up here and took my tablet and just, Israel really does not want a king. Samuel again goes to the Lord in prayer. You would go, right? Okay, so, but whenever a church puts in as a value of entertainment, that's one of their goals, whether it is explicitly said or implicitly done by the way they maneuver services, specifically on Sunday morning. If entertainment is a goal, like, hey, we got to keep the people coming and do blank, blank, and blank, and blank. Okay? When you do that, what happens? Okay, let's go back to the story. When Israel wanted to be like the nations, what did being like the nations do? What did they want? They wanted a king. And did the king, what did the king do? He take and make. So I thought this week, if the church wants to be like the world and insert entertainment, that's the church's king, entertainment. You see the connection I'm trying to make here? All right. Israel wants a king. The king takes and makes. The church wants entertainment. So then I had to ask, what does entertainment take and make? So when we value entertainment, if our goal on Sunday morning is for you to leave entertained, what will entertainment take from you and us? You with me so far? All right, here's what it'll take. Got three things. They're on your outline. You can look at them. Entertainment takes the opportunity to build quality relationships. Here's what I mean. If my goal for you is to leave and go, man, that was awesome. Boy, the lights and the smoke and whoa, man, I felt like I went to a concert today. Woo! Guess what you have not done? Yes, that wasn't one on the list, but y'all get a gold star over here. No, what you hadn't done is you hadn't invested in the people that are sitting around you. You have, if my goal is entertainment, there's no shake hands time. You want to know why? Because that's not entertaining. But why do we do that? Because it creates interconnectivity and opportunity to build relationships. If it's all about entertainment, I'm not worried about whether you've been to Sunday school or not. Come on. I'm not. It would not be a core value that you be in a Sunday school class if we were all about entertainment. Because I don't care if you go to Sunday school. I just want you to walk away going, wow. Love the Lord. Yes. All right. Thanks, guys. We did not plan that, by the way. You know, but for real, like, we're not worried about that. I'm not worried about how things look and sound. Ooh, a little power spike there. Yeah, there we go. Yes. All right, Mr. Ernie's going to get our speakers in a second. All right, so, but we're not worried about that, right? That was totally unplanned. It was not part of this. We did not talk about that. Anyway, but we're not worried about that because what if it's all about entertainment, it's about how can I get you back next week to be entertained again? I'm not worried about what relationships are you building? And when you're in trouble in life, are you calling your small group or the people that you're friends with and that you're building relationships here? If entertainment is the value, then entertainment will take in proportion, put it this way. entertainment proportionally decreases the likelihood of biblical fidelity or faithfulness. So as we value entertainment more, the likelihood that I'm going to be faithful to the Bible as a preacher and I'm going to be encouraging you to be faithful to the Bible decreases. Why? Because there's some uncomfortable parts of the Bible and that does not facilitate entertainment. Do we want to talk about the parts that are going to challenge us? No. I just want you to feel good and come back next week. The more entertainment, it takes the focus. Now, listen. When we value entertainment, entertainment takes the focus off the Lord and spotlights the talents or abilities of the entertainers. Listen, I'm going to be real with you. Do you know why I'm up here every week? Base level. Do you know why I speak every week? It's because I'm good at speaking. That's it. But I may not be the best at running the back end of things at the church. I may not be the best at the technology. I may not be the best at pastoral care. I may not be the best at garnering resources for children's ministry or encouraging this and this. I just get to do this because I'm good at talking. Right? The people who are on the stage are just good at that thing. People who are on the stage singing are great singers. When they were in their mother's womb, did they go up to heaven and say, "Hey God, can I get an extra measure of singing talent?" No. God just graciously gave them a gift. But yet if the value is on entertainment, the focus is decreasingly on the Lord and more on the person who got the gift from the Lord. And we hold them up and go, "Look, I'm telling you, I've been doing this since 2001. This is exactly what happens. This is it. When we value entertainment, the focus goes off of the Lord and on to those who are in the spotlight, whether they deserve it or not. And only because we just get to see the one thing they're really good at. I've been doing this long enough to see all the celebrity pastors who everybody thought was, as my dad says, the best thing since sliced bread, who now are not in ministry because they were deplorable off the stage. But everybody thought they were great just because they could talk really good and throw nice little quibby sound bites that were tweetable every Sunday. And why does that happen? Because we valued entertainment but not realizing what entertainment would take. Because whenever the church chases to live like the nations, it's going to take something. It's a trade-off. And sometimes it takes more than we want or in ways we didn't plan. Right? Our goal here is not entertainment. Our goal is personal relationships, biblical fidelity. Our goal is to help you move and you move toward Christ and you bring someone along with you as y'all are moving toward Christ through reading your Bible and praying, through being in a small group, through serving, through giving, and through engaging people, especially those who are far from Jesus. Like, that's why those are our goals, because according to the way I read the Bible, that's what the Bible says we ought to be doing as a church. Right now that was, all right. But now let's get serious, as if that wasn't serious enough. Personal. Because we can desire to live like the world personally as well. And there's any number of ways we can take this, but we only got time for one. All right, success. So when success Success is tricky because no one wants to lose. You don't want to lose at life. You want to win at life. That's cool. That's a God-given desire, I believe, that He puts inside of us to want to win. Nobody wakes up in the morning and says, I hope I lose it all today. Nobody. Right? We all want to win. But what the nations tell us is that success is determined by material possessions or materialistic things. And whenever we say, I want to live like the world, and define that as material success, it will take from us that stepping away from God's best, because God, you say, well, how does God define success? Faithfulness. That's it. It's a simple math equation. Success equals faithfulness in God's eyes. But whenever we define success as material possessions, we're stepping away from God's best and we're stepping into a make and take relationship. And you say, what does that take? When we affirm the nation's plural idea of success, it takes away opportunities for intentional time with the Lord. Why are you going to spend time with the Lord? That's 15 minutes you could be making calls. That's 15 minutes you could be responding to emails. That's 30 minutes you could be trying to make a sale. If it is about acquiring as much success as we can, you will be more likely to spend less time with the Lord, not more time with the Lord. Because that is time, and time is money. Right? Come on. If we take the nation's idea of success, it takes away the willingness to give and serve. Why am I going to give and serve? How is that going to help me be successful in the world's idea of material possessions? Why am I going to give you? Because you lazy and you ain't done what I've done. I'm not giving you nothing. Come on. Why would I choose to come up to the church and serve when I could work an hour longer and make three more sales? Why would I choose to come work with some snotty-nosed kids and some over-the-top teenagers on Wednesday night? You're not. Because you've beholden to success is material possessions, which is less than God's best for your life. If you do that, if you take the nation's idea of success, it takes away the desires to invest in others. Why am I going to help you when you could potentially be competition that I'm going to have to face? Y'all know I love football. I can't tell you how many times I have heard NFL quarterbacks say something along this. When they're asked, hey, you know, you're a veteran in the league, been in the league 10 years. Y'all drafted a rookie quarterback. Are you gonna invest in him? No, he's a professional now. He can do it himself. Why does that veteran quarterback not want to take that young guy under his wing? Because he might take my job. Well, buddy, if you're good enough, you're going to keep your job. But he don't want to invest in him because one day he might be competition. And whenever we have an idea of the world's view of success, we are less likely to invest in others because that is a time we could be spending to make, and that person might be a potential obstacle in our way of making it where we want to make. Now, the flip of this is whenever we stay in God's best, which is success equals faithfulness, what do? The exact opposite of these. Because it's not about how much can I make, it's how much can I give. Right? It's how many people can I invest in, because one day I'm not going to be able to do all I can do now. One day, to quote the elders to Samuel, you old. One day I'm not going to be able to do what I'm doing now. So how many people can I invest in today to make sure this thing keeps going beyond me? How many people, how can I give and serve because God has given to me? How can I reciprocate God's attitude toward others? Right? So there's just two examples. I don't know where they hit you today. But I will say this in general. Whenever we walk away from God's best, we are always settling for less. And that less will always take and make in ways you didn't want it to, and in ways you couldn't account for, and in more ways than you were expecting. And one day down the road, you're going to look and go, God, what happened? And then you're going to have to do the hard, swallow the hard truth of, this is what I asked the Lord for. And then you're going to realize, unfortunately, you've wasted all this time in your life trying to build this thing that was less than what it could have been. Now, here's the great thing about the Bible. Here's the great thing about the Lord. He is always open and ready for us to return to Him in repentance and faith and to come back to Him. But here's what it's like. All right, last illustration, then we're done. Here's what it's like. Just so you know, I want you to be fully informed when you leave. Imagine this is God's track for your life. Imagine your train. Is that how trains sound today, Mason? Whoop, whoop. Pretty close. There we go. All right. Whoop, 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 whoop. All right, you're going down the track. And say you decide to go off for the Lord from the Lord's best. And you kind of take this little deep spur line. Am I right? Am I good so far? Okay. I didn't pre-approve this with him beforehand. You take the spur line off. And let's say you go down that for 10 years. Yeah, the Lord will absolutely forgive you. But you just don't get to go, whoop! You don't get to just jump over here. You got to start back down here because you just wasted 10 years of your life because you decided you wanted to trade in God's best for something that was less. And then when you got down the line, you realized this spur line ain't quite what it was chalked up to be. And it taked and maked in ways I wasn't expecting. Yes, the Lord will forgive you, but you're going to come all the way back here and got to start over from where you left off walking with the Lord. And that it will be the greatest decision you've ever made. And it will be awesome. And it will be, but just know that whenever we give up God's best for something that's less, it's going to take and make in ways we couldn't imagine. And I do not want that to happen to you. I want you to choose God's best for your life every single day. As a church, that means we're not going to value entertainment. We're going to value biblical fidelity, biblical truth, and relationships in a nutshell. Personally, that means we shouldn't go after material success, possessions as the world defines it, but as Jesus defines it, as being faithful. Right? That's what I want for you today. So, hey, I know we kind of shot with the shotgun today, so to speak. And I don't know how this landed for you, but Mr. Ernie's going to come up. We're going to play a song, and we're going to go into an invitation time. And so however you need to respond during this time, let me encourage you that.
Thanks for listening. For more information about Valley Grove, visit our Facebook page or website, valleygrovechurch.org.